juice got out pretty ambitiously. This person don't want to fill that car in. I'm like, ah, ooh. Very foreboding. Well, you said it's so upbeat. Come on, all right.
Well, I don't see death as a bad thing. I see it as something that's inevitable. And I've had some time between now and then to obviously do some stuff. And I hope that when I die that someone would stand up at my funeral and say, Daniel was a good man, you know. And if I can achieve stuff between now and then to make people stay happy, and then I reckon I probably would.
And we're, okay, so let's say, let's go over the scene. Should we turn on the light, or are the lights okay with everyone?
No. Well, it's dark now, I'm not going to read.
It's not going on.
It's off.
Oh, do you want me to turn it back on?
Yeah, because that's the switch.
I don't know, we'll find out.
That's what you want to do. Okay, so you can see the light. All right, let's say we're at Daniel's funeral then. There you are, you're laying in state. You come to pay our last respects, and then you give a speech. You can say, just make a eulogy. He was a good guy. He helped old ladies walk across the street. He contributed to the youth rugby league.
Jim Mustafa. He's a good father. He's a family member. Member of community.
Okay, and then I stand up at your funeral. Excuse me. Where is Daniel now? What would you expect that they would say?
He did. He's flying here in the cup and he's dead.
That's it. Finish.
I don't think people would say that. They'd say you're always in heaven. Or.
What do you mean, like, an afterlife? You're not talking about my physical.
I think we're talking
about. Well, you tell us what we're talking about. Yeah, you tell us.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think people would probably say, well,
heaven, if they're a Christian. Yeah. Of course, New Zealand's not known for its Christian population.
Well, my family's probably Christian, so I'm guessing that it's
heaven. You went to heaven because why? As if you're dead, you're not going to go to heaven.
Oh, well, I guess it. Yeah, I know if you're a good person or something, you're not getting in.
And who decides who's a good person? Each person now decides I'm a good person, then you go to heaven.
I guess the God in the cage. I'm not sure.
Well, it sounds pretty, Go ahead, have a seat. Yeah. We're in the middle of a funeral right now. Daniel just died, and because he said that his goal in life is to be known as a good guy. So I spat out some things that people might be saying at his funeral. He helped old ladies walk across the street. He contributed to the youth rugby league. He said, oh, that sounds good, and he added some stuff. He's a good family man, he's a good father, And then I said, well, suppose I stand up. Wait a minute, but where is Daniel now? And you're fine. He's dead, he's finished. So now we're at that point of discussion. And Ron, you're interjecting some things. He's in heaven. So, then I asked Daniel, what makes you think you go to heaven? I mean, if you're a good guy, you go there. But what does it mean to be a good guy? Well, it's ask the gatekeeper, Dad. That's where we are now. Because we've been discussing goals in life, because we have a bit of a hefty list here, digging below hidden baggage, underlying commitments. So we were asking what everyone's goals, and he just started off spontaneously in an upbeat way. When I die, no one usually starts talking like that. Usually that's considered a gloomy, melancholy subject. So, it doesn't seem like you're too sure about the qualifications for where you're going.
Well, I think I've come to the opinion that, when I'm dead, there's a junction there. So, what I really need to work on is what I'm doing between now and that junction rather than what's coming after that junction. That's in my head. Well, and to make the most of the time that I've kind of got on earth, I think.
Well, where do you get the idea of the junction from?
Well, death is the junction.
And so where are the possible roads?
Well, when I die, there's a junction there because obviously my physical life is ending. Yeah. I'm on to something else. What I go on to, I'm not sure.
And what is going on?
What do you mean?
When the physical self, as you say, is dead, I'll go on. What's that I that's going on?
Well, I guess there's two possibilities. There's possibility A, that that's it, that's the end, or possibility B, that the spiritual self will continue on into some other form. The exact nature of that I can't be sure of, because in my current form, I don't have any way of kind of crossing across to check it out. So I guess that's why I see it as a junction.
But if there's some way you can get information, a map of the junction coming up ahead, wouldn't that help?
I think so. I guess the thing in life is there are many different opinions on what that map is.
Alright, but suppose you can get a map as well as directions how to corroborate what the map says.
Well, I guess that's my original point, and the fact is that the map and the opinions differ depending on your culture and religion and what era of society you come from.
Really? So if I said, here's the way to get from here to Queen Street, this is the quickest way if you're driving, you would tell me, well, that depends on your culture, it depends on your social background.
I definitely think so, because if you're a capitalist, money-hungry person, you'd probably get in the jag and be here in 2 seconds, whereas if you don't believe in the physical items, you'd probably walk, so it'd probably take you another extra 10 minutes, or you could probably cut through a bypass. That's just an example.
No, but let's say you're driving. Now, there's no doubt that there's a quickest way to get to Queen Street Customs, by driving. So, if I say, you just go down, continue on down here, and like that, and would you say to me, but it depends on your culture, it depends on your social upbringing.
Well, I think so, because I guess the easiest way to explain the thing that I'm trying to think through is, I guess there are different types of cars, and they will go at different types of rate, even though they're getting, I guess, to a similar spatial area.
Oh,
that's what I'm trying to.
But still, there obviously is, if you're driving, a quickest way to get to Queen Street, Lower Queen Street. Yeah.
I guess so.
Yeah. Okay. So then, it could be, answer to the point you're raising, it could be that there are definite realities in terms of birth and death. And one has the information and one is given the means to verify that information. What would you say?
I don't know, I was talking about how quickly you get there, but it doesn't really matter how fast you get there.
Well, in this case, I was
thinking... Maybe like sort of living outside, but it's sort of like living only sort of 10 years and then somewhere else I'm living 10 years.
Now, whether you live 10 years or 30 years, where are you going? Like if someone asks you, I'm sorry, what's your name?
Jody.
Jody. Jody, what's your goal? Where are you going? What would you say?
That sounds so different.
Or you're still looking for what your goal is?
Direction.
Yeah. All right. Now, let's say Leon gets it. Well, I'm still looking for direction. We would notice in Leon that it's not that he's stopped all activity, he's just looking. He's still doing things. So, one question, especially when we're dealing with hidden baggage and underlying commitments, what is it that we're doing and why, even though we're still searching for the goal? It's not that we're just going to sit here and search. No, we're all doing things. So, we can see that we have other goals, other priorities, than just searching for what is the ultimate goal, because we're doing things. It's not that most people are just sitting in their flat, okay, I'm just going to wait until I find my goal, I'm just going to... No, they're doing things, they're acting in this world, they're trying to achieve things. Why is that? He's just got to do something.
Everyone else seems to be doing stuff.
So it influences you to do something, even though you don't know what you're doing.
Sure, like sometimes I feel like I'm stumbling a little bit, like maybe partially blindfolded and try to see a little bit of light and then sort of try and catch up with it.
I think everyone's kind of going with it. I'd like to be helping the kids. Because the reason that a lot of people do things, whether it's the search of physical items or helping out other people, it's because you get a feeling of happiness.
Now, how long do the feelings last?
Well, that's the thing. They usually
get around with something. Yeah, that's what they do. How long do those feelings last?
They seem to be quite short term, and that's why people are forever on the bicycle trying to continue their feeling for as long as possible by acquiring more things or helping more people or
acquiring more relationships.
Yeah.
So then what to do? You're the good guy.
I guess it's like eating, you know, you eat some stuff and you're content for a while and then after a while you get hungry again and so you need to go back and eat some more food. And I guess it's the quality of the food that determines your health. So I guess the things we should be searching for should be the good quality food, emotional rather than physical.
So you're the official Mr. Good Guy here tonight. You said that when you die you want to be known, that you're a good guy. Okay, so we're relying on you as the official good guy representative. How does a good guy cope with this thing about temporary feelings of happiness and contentment that come and go so quickly? How do you get a good guy in a world of temporary good feelings and temporary feelings of contentment?
I think it possibly comes down to discipline.
Discipline?
Yeah. Because hey, I'm not expert, but from my own experiences, I've found that in times when I've been more disciplined, and then giving myself small rewards, I felt a lot happier than sometimes when I've been undisciplined or just given things off straight off the bat.
Or when you went on a binge.
Yeah. So it's kind of about, I guess, having something of order and then just rewarding yourself with little things every now and again.
That's all you can expect. Just reward yourself with the little things every now and again.
If you're looking for long-term fulfillment, it's possibly the easiest way, not easiest, but the way to get a constant supply of, I guess, fulfillment.
All right. So what would you consider long-term fulfillment, Jeremy?
External things to give me that peace of mind.
Where would it come from then?
From within, from reading the Gita, from meditating, from chanting, from seeking something from a higher power.
So, what do we hope to achieve? You hope to be the good guy at the time of death, at his funeral, they'll be saying the good guy. You hope to achieve peace and contentment. You're trying to figure it out, fair enough. You want peace and contentment. What did you say? Often I wonder, this gets back to the hidden baggage and underlying commitments. Are we really ready to pay the price for our desired goals? That's probably what's making you a bit hesitant. You see a lot of people set goals and say, I want this and that. But then their actions speak something else. In other words, not really ready to pay the price for their goals. Kind of like a fat person who says, you know, I only go on a diet, but I just keep eating, you know, hamburgers. Or someone who said, I should exercise, and they just never put the time in. So, what is it that we're really attached to? What is it that really is our vested interest? Like, you just don't, I'm sure you don't sit around in your flat and just, I want to be known as a good guy when I die. I want to be known as a good guy when I die. At my funeral, I want to be established as a good guy. You're doing things, right?
Sometimes I just run around and think about stuff.
Yeah, but not all the time. You're out and about trying to, what?
Catching up with people. Playing sports.
Yeah.
Just,
being active and trying to accomplish things. Establishing relationships, deepening relationships, interacting through sports and social gatherings, and just like a honeybee going from flower to flower, taking a little pollen from this one, a little pollen from that one, right?
And you can see something.
Yeah, so you're trying to achieve something. You're trying to taste the pleasure of, you know, buzzing around to different situations, different circumstances, different people, and take a little bit from here, take a little bit from there. Feel good that the people think you're a good guy, right? Yay, here comes Daniel, he thinks good guy. Gives you a great feeling, right?
I wish it does.
So, there's your hidden baggage. The emotional fulfillment you get by being known as a good guy. Yeah, Daniel, he's a good guy. He can depend on him. I mean, you know, he's got a good character. He knows how to have a good time, too. That's getting baggage.
I don't know if it's it's so hidden.
No, I was just being generous. Now, will that, and we don't need to use examples, we're going to say something, but will that quest, your actual quest, will that satisfy you? Yeah, everybody's approval. As we show up at a social gathering or sports conference. Hey, Daniel! Oh, yeah. Come on over, Daniel. Yeah. Good you showed up. Good on you. But you kind of like show up for some informal sports competition or actual
touch rugby.
Yes. Some spontaneous kind of thing. Yeah, okay, yeah, he's on our side. How do you do it here?
I think on many occasions, like you say, that's right. You know, there is that need to be at least light. But at the same time, I'm never sure if I know that what I feel is the correct way is not going to be the most right way. I'm never sure if I stand alone to make sure that there's no right.
All right. Well, but how would you know what's the right way? Well, that's, we don't have, how do you know what the right way is?
Probably one of the most complicated questions around, because I look at doing something for me the right way. I think of a physical, like actually, say, building a chest, and you know, some carpenter, of course, says, oh, you might have the corners and that kind of stuff, or you know, use wood or oak or cedar, or I suppose the right way is the way that gets consensus, but then gets the job done as well. That you need a certain amount of consensus from different people and things, but I think you need a plan that everybody understands. So,
doesn't it come back to personal values? The right way, you measure that against your own personal values inside yourself. Because different people have different sets of values, and that's why you keep disagreeing on what's the right way.
Yes, billions of people, so each person, individual did that, get very confusing, huh?
Conditioning, upbringing, experience, we tend to determine our own right way by inputs we receive. I don't think we have a rule book which says, if you do this, this is going to be the result. But you know, based on experience, if you do this, the result is going to be this for itself. Experience based thing.
How do you figure out what's the right thing?
Probably what the majority thing.
What's that?
What society is saying as well. I suppose just to know in the mind what's acceptable and what's not.
It's interesting. It's a central question for Bhagavad Gita. I know some of you are reading Bhagavad Gita. Some of you are dead.
I'm about 3 times, 4 times through.
Yeah. You're finished?
Hey, chapter 8.
I have no idea what the book is.
Yeah, fair enough. So, it's about a battlefield situation. And this person named Arjuna, he's in a difficult bind. He's a professional military man. That's his trade. as a professional military man according to the ancient Vedic civilization of India. He is supposed to fight in a just cause. In other words, he's meant to defend the innocent against aggressors, injustice like that. The problem is that on the other side, the opposing side, are members of his extended family. Not immediate family, but extended family. Big dynasty, so second and third cousins and things like that, on the other side. Former friends, former teachers, they were on the other side. So he became quite bewildered. How can I fight? Look who the opponents are. They're family, friends, former teachers. How can I do this? Now, just to give you a full background, the other side had done atrocities. They had been the aggressors. They tried to rub out Arjuna and his family. They tried to life in public. They tried to burn down his house. All these things which you're more than justified to defend yourself. But Arjuna is very soft-hearted. And he's thinking, just because they are acting in such a way, why should we reciprocate? Two wrongs don't make a right. Now, the fact was, according to any kind of religious principles, he's not wrong. He's acting in self-defense. But still, he's so soft-hearted, he's thinking, how can I fight this battle? Look, it's my own family, friends, relatives on the other side. Just because they're wrong, still, I need to go through all this. So then you have the presence of Lord Krishna, the main speaker of Bhagavad Gita. And he's teaching Arjuna that you're lamenting for the body, and actually the body is not that important. You don't understand the reality of the sphere of soul is most important. Therefore, you should fight this battle and not take so seriously the comings and goings of the material bodies. First of all, the battle should be fought for obvious reasons. And then secondly, you shouldn't hesitate in fighting because it's your duty, Kshatriya's duty. Thirdly, because I want you to fight. So, number three, I want you to fight depends on your understanding of who is this personality who wants you to fight. Is it an ordinary personality? First, let's turn to chapter 2, text 11. That's page 87. I just stick your thumb there. Before you get there, I'm going to read some introductory mantras. And for those of you who haven't heard these mantras before, don't worry. Even if you don't understand what they mean, the sound vibration purifies the atmosphere. So I'll be chanting these mantras, these ancient Sanskrit mantras, starting on page 1. But just keep your thumb on page 87, because we'll be going right to that. So I'll start chanting these powerful mantras, very purifying mantras, on page 1. Om Jnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manovishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantitam Bandeham Sri Guru Sri Yudhapada Kamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavanshta Sri Rupam Sahajatam Sahagana-raginatam vitandham sajivam Sadvaitam Sahajutam Paritana-sahitam Krishna-chaitanya-devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Adavita Sri Vishakam Vitanscha. Hey Krishna Karana Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Lathe Vrindavaneshwari Krishna Bhanu Sutta Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama Rama Rama, Hare Hare. All right, let's turn to page 87. Here we're going to find Lord Krishna speaking to Arjuna. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Ashochan Antashochastvam Pradya Bharam Chabhasha Se Katasun Akatasun Cha Nanu Shochati Pandita. Would you like to read the translation, Daniel?
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, not worthy of lamentation, nor lamenting, and then talks, also speaking in lost life, in a past life, also never lament.
Oh no, just read the translation. Yes. That was
a. Yes. Oh, the translation,
I read it? Yeah.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, while speaking winged words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise and remember for the living and for the dead.
Yes, this is Krishna setting Arjuna straight. You're speaking big words. They sound very religious, very sociological, very ethical, but you actually don't know what you're talking about. Arjuna was giving his reasons why he didn't want to fight this battle. So Krishna is telling him, you're speaking big words, very learned sounding, but you're lamenting about what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living nor the dead. Why is it that those who are wise lament neither for the living nor the dead? What would you say, Leo? The physical body is temporary. It comes and goes. So what's the point in lamenting about something so temporary, so flickering? Find the real person who's beyond the coming and going of the body. You can read the purport.
The Lord at once took the position of the teacher and chastised the student, calling him indirectly a fool. The Lord said, you are talking like a learned man, but you do not know that one who is learned, one who knows what is the body and what is the soul, does not lament for any stage of the body, neither in the living nor in the dead condition. As explained in later chapters, it will be clear that knowledge means to know matter and spirit and the controller of God.
Very important sense. Could you read that again? As explained.
As explained in later chapters, it will be clear that knowledge means to know matter and spirit and the controller of God.
Arjuna?
Arjuna argued that religious principles should be given more importance than politics or sociology. But he did not know that knowledge of matter, soul, and the supreme is more important than religious morality. Because he was lacking in that knowledge, he should not have posed himself as a very learned man. As he did not happen to be very learned, and he was consequently lamenting for something which was unworthy of lamentation. The body is born and is
destined
to be vanquished today or tomorrow. Therefore, the body is not as important as the soul. One who knows this is actually learned, and by thinking that is no choice for meditation, regardless of the condition of the human body.
So, there you have it. The body is here today, gone tomorrow, but you're not the body. So why lament? Just like if your jumper becomes torn or it becomes old, you have a big breakdown because of it, a big lamination because of it. No, it's not me, it's just a covering. I'll get something else to wear. I'll get another body. So this way, Krishna is saying, those who are actually wise, they don't lament for the living or the dead, because both are temporary conditions. Being alive, being dead. They are just different stations on the cycle of birth and death. Just like when you were little kids, you might have ridden on a carousel. Yes. So you go around and around and around. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains the cycle of repeated birth and death. You go round and round. Take birth, die, take birth again, die, take birth again, die. Coming to the body comes into being, goes out of being. So why should an intelligent person lament about this constant coming and going? When the real person, the spirit soul, is untouched by all these phases of the body. So therefore Krishna is saying, you're speaking big words about ethics, rightness, morality, so-called religion, but actually someone who is intelligent never laments for all this. They understand clearly. They're not the body. They're spirit soul. This is the first step in being a good guy. Understanding, as stated here. It will be clear that knowledge means to know matter and spirit and the controller of both. This is a hefty goal in that. To know matter and spirit and the controller of both. In other words, it's not that there's just matter and spirit out there floating on their own. No. They have a controller. They have a source. So knowledge needs to understand the controller and the source of the matter and the spirit. That's what Krishna is teaching in Bhagavad Gita. So Daniel, what would you say if Krishna said this directly to you? The Supreme Personality God has said, Daniel, while speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living nor the dead. What would you say?
You've got a good point.
What did you say to him? But then we find ourselves lamenting. We find ourselves going through various phases of happiness and distress about temporary material conditions and our temporary material body. Why is that? Theoretically, we may have some idea, I must be something more than the body, but we don't have a lifestyle that will allow us to live as spirit soul. So many people, they talk about how, yeah, I know I'm spiritual, I know I'm more than the body, but their lifestyle is simply bodily, material, because they have no information how to live the lifestyle as a spirit soul. Lifestyle is very important. Your lifestyle should be based on your underlying commitments. Your hidden baggage should be revealed in terms of your lifestyle. If you actually understand that there is existence beyond the body, there's something non-material about your identity, then you should demonstrate a non-material lifestyle. And this is where there's a big gap between some of our theoretical speculations and reality. That's why in Bhagavad Gita, the most confidential thing taught in Bhagavad Gita is not that you're a spirit soul, but the activities of the spirit soul in perfection. That's the most confidential knowledge. So we have a feeling that we're more than the body, yet our lifestyle is a bodily attachment. Can you see that?
Yeah. I can see what he's coming from.
Yeah. Can you see that? The lifestyle is a bodily attachment. Even the ones talk about spirituality and this and that. The lifestyle is one of them. Bodily attachment. In other words, if we're going to directly perceive our spiritual identity, we need a way to walk our talk. We need to enter into the laboratory and get some practical results, rather than just believe. I think, yeah, I'll be a good guy, everyone will know that. If there's a heaven, I guess I'll be going there. We need some concrete facts, some direct experience. Would you want that? In order to do that, we need to acquire the best fund of knowledge and information possible. Just like if you were going to tour Mexico, you get as much, you know, guidebooks as you can, and some guidebooks are better than others. You get a little small one, which has things in it, facts in it, it's just small. Or you get a big thick one, Lonely Planet's Guidebook to Mexico, or something like that, or Father's Guide. Now, both the tiny little guidebook and the big thick one, they're both reasonably correct and accurate, reasonably. Still, there's a difference between the tiny one and the big one. Similarly, Bhagavad Gita will teach you things that you'll find in other holy books, but there's much in Bhagavad Gita you won't find anywhere else. If we will allow ourselves to get caught up in this dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, you're noticing how it develops as you're in chapter 8. You notice you're starting to get caught up in the dialogue. The dialogue starts to rework your brain. You start getting a new vision for what is important and what is not important. You start to be able to see the forest and the trees. That's the mystery of Bhagavad Gita. I suppose when you first started around, it seemed like a bit exotic, another world. Huh? Yeah. And then what happened after a while?
It was like a roadmap.
Right. All of a sudden you realize, hey, I got a map on my hand. Mm-hmm. How far into it did you get that feeling?
I think it took happened this the second time. You know. So I tend to read bits and pieces. You know.
Jumping around?
No, I read it from cover to cover, but there's no real continuity because at the stage I was reading, I decided, you know, yeah, I read the Bible as well, and just prove it I could do it. And when I came back the second time, then I started to question and delve and absorb rather than reading it as a story.
It's amazing how often people don't want a map. They want to drive without a map. I actually think it's inferior to drive and consult a map or even to ask directions. You get to a new city and you would just, let me just drive around and see what I can, if I can find my way. You wouldn't ask anybody, you wouldn't look at a map. Yeah. So many people approach life in that way. If you're actually serious about getting to your destination in the quickest amount of time, then you'll want the guidance of a map and you'll pull over and ask directions. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is giving directions. Of course, then you would want to understand, well, who is Krishna? Why should I take him so seriously? Once you start understanding who Krishna is, then your life really takes off into another, onto another level. Let's turn to page 113. Ashchaya vat pashyati pashyatenam ashchaya vat vadati tataiva chanya ashchaya vat chainam anyat shrinoti śrutvāpyanam veda na caiva kaścit. Leanne, you want to read the translation?
Mm-hmm. Some look on the soul as amazing, some describe him as amazing, and some hear of him as amazing, while others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all.
Yes. When we're materialistically trained, it's hard to understand that there is a spiritual particle that is powering the body. Because you can't see that spiritual particle with ordinary material senses, ordinary perception, you can easily say, it doesn't exist. But how many of you have seen an X-ray before? No, it's actually seen, not the reproduction, but you actually see the X-rays going through the air. No. How many of you have seen the wind? No. You just see the effects of the wind. How many of you have seen your own mind? No, you don't see your mind. You can feel the effects of your mind. You don't see it. So there's so many powerful things that we accept the existence of, even though we've never seen them. Therefore, why is it so difficult to accept that there's a particle of spiritual energy that's powering the body, even though we haven't seen it? Therefore, Krishna says, some look on the soul as amazing, some describe him as amazing, Some hear of him as amazing, while others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all. You want to read the purport?
Yeah, sure. Since
Upanishad
is largely based on principles of the
Upanishads,
it is not surprising to also find this passage in the Katha Upanishad.
Shravanaya vipahubhye no labhya shinvatopi bahavo yana vriju ascharya bhakta kushalosya labhya ascharya cha gyata kushalanushishta.
The fact that the atomic soul is within the body of a gigantic animal and the body of a gigantic banyan tree and also in the microbic germs, millions and billions of which occupy only an inch of space, it is certainly very amazing. Men with a poor fund of knowledge and men who are not austere cannot understand the wonders of the individual atomic spark of spirit. Even though it is explained by the great authority of knowledge and imparted lessons even to Brahma, the first living being in the universe, owing to a gross material perception of things, most men in this age cannot imagine how small such a particle can become, both so great and so small. So men look at the soul proper as wonderful either by constitution or by description. Illusion by the material energy, people are so engrossed in subject matters for sense gratification that they have very little time to understand the question of self-understanding. Even though it is a fact that without this self-understanding, all activities in ultimate defeat in the struggle for existence. Perhaps they have no idea that one must think of the soul and thus make a solution to the material miseries. Some people who are inclined to hear about the soul may be attending lectures in good association, but sometimes, owing to ignorance, they are misguided by acceptance of the super soul and the atomic soul as one without distinction of magnitude. It is very difficult to find a man who perfectly understands the position of the super soul, the atomic soul, their retrospective functions and relationships, and all other major and minor details. And it is still more difficult to find a man who has actually derived full benefit from the knowledge of the soul and who is able to describe the position of the soul in different aspects. But if somehow or other one is able to understand the subject matter of a soul, then one's life is successful. The easiest process for understanding the subject matter of self, however, is to accept the statements of the Bhagavad Gita spoken by the greatest authority, Lord Krishna, without being deviated by other theories. But it also requires a great deal of penance and sacrifice, either in this life or the previous ones. Before one is able to accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhood, Krishna can, however, be known as such by the causeless mercy of a pure devotee and by no other way.
Right. Any questions about all this? What do you think, Daniel? Sounds interesting?
Yes.
Why different?
Because it's just lots of different ways of looking at the situation, and a different pose. One that's, I guess, more is a different angle.
I like this sentence beginning on the bottom of page 113. Sense of being illusioned. Illusion by the material energy, people are so engrossed in subject matters for sense gratification that they have very little time to understand the question of self-understanding. Even though it is a fact that without the self-understanding, all activities result in ultimate defeat in the struggle for existence. Perhaps they have no idea that one must think of the soul and thus make a solution to the material miseries.
What do you think, Joe?
It's different sense of thinking about. In today's society, people are just like taking time to think about the soul as sort of like a, like they don't have time for it. Like they're too wrapped up in trying to look into their own existence.
And many people just kind of say, yeah, spirituality, yeah, I mean, everybody's spiritual in their own way. You just got to do what you think is the thing to do, you know. It'll all work out, you know. You've got a good feeling in your heart. Surely good will come to you. No one is trying to get precise, definitive knowledge of the self, the soul. Because if you actually know what is the soul, then your next question will be, what are the activities of the pure soul? I know what material activities are, but what are pure spiritual activities? That's the next question. Because of our hidden baggage, we deny ourselves the chance to make use of the golden opportunity of our having a human body, which gives the advanced developed consciousness by which we can understand thoughts like we're having now. You don't see any plants and animals and bugs sitting here listening. Humans can because they have developed consciousness. But if we misuse that advanced consciousness of human beings simply to pursue the same things that the animals are pursuing, this is a great disaster, a great loss. Animals want security. They want freedom from attack. Animals want to reproduce. They want to eat, and they want to sleep. If human beings reduce themselves to those activities, although in a more sophisticated way, still the same basic activities, this is the greatest loss. So the hidden baggage, the underlying commitments, they are based on attachment that we have for this body, which we're not. Being attached to our body is as crazy as my being attached to this jacket I'm wearing. This is me. It's a real thing. It's me. Of course, you'd say that's crazy. You're not that dark. Certainly, Mother Gita, Krishna says, you're not that body. Now, how do we live like we're not the body? That's the next question. In this way, by your seriously considering these points, you're actually entering into the world of Krishna consciousness. You're becoming conscious of Krishna because it is Krishna who is teaching you these things. He's speaking to you in Bhagavad Gita. Now, there can be so many authorities. There can be so many spiritual books and spiritual teachers. But in Bhagavad Gita, you have the obvious advantage of taking knowledge directly from the source of everything. If you can get your knowledge from the source of all matter and spirit, then you're really in an advantageous position, a most advantageous position. So there may be so many people proffering roadmaps to you, directions. Just go here, just go around that corner. If you're ever driving in India and you ask for road directions, you'll find that people are very happy to just tell you anything. Just because they're just trying to be helpful, so that even though they don't know, they'll just say, oh, yes, just go this way. Even though they don't know. Because, you know, it's just, it's the right thing to do there. Just say something and be helpful. Oh. Often they won't even speak. They'll just make that motion with their hand. Yeah, like, you know. Or just motion with their head. And you, oh, okay, straight ahead. And you go and you're lost. It's not considered a bad thing to do there. Yeah. Just be helpful, yeah. So, there can be so many people offering you roadmaps, so many people offering you directions. But you want the most authorized roadmaps, the most authorized directions. What can be more authorized than your taking knowledge directly from the source of all energies? That's the advantage of Bhagavad-gita. Now, if there's a way that you can verify that Krishna is the source of all energies, then you're really in for something. Because you might be thinking, oh, well, Bhagavad-gita says Krishna, something else says something else, this, that, and the other. But in Bhagavad-gita, you get the process for verifying your identity as spirit soul and verifying who is Krishna. You get a laboratory experience. So today I had to go to a laboratory, diagnostic center, because I'm applying for my Russian visa, which I get every year. They have a new law. You get a multiple entry visa to Russia, you have to have an HIV test. So, oh my God, I get, you know, I need my visa now. Oh, it's a new law, I'm just going to do it. So I have to go to a medical lab, get this test done real quick. So it's a laboratory procedure. They stick the needle in, they take some blood, they analyze the blood. And then you get a piece of paper, you send that to the consulate. Actually, the doctor told me, you know, you could have just gone on a PC and produced your own medical paper. I said, yeah, that's true. What am I doing here? So yeah, just pack, you know, print out something and fax it to them. Anyway, I'm here now, so. So, laboratory, diagnostics. Same thing in Bhagavad-gita. You want to understand what is the source of everything. You want to understand Krishna, the Supreme Soul, and you as the individual soul. Then there's laboratory procedures. Then there can be peace and contentment. But you have to have knowledge and a proper lifestyle. You cannot just live in ignorance and then say, peace, contentment. Where is it? Bhagavad-gita will teach you that we need to be more than just a good guy, a right guy. We have to be full of knowledge. We have to know what is what. What is matter? What is spirit? And what is the source, the controller of both? Then our life is successful. But because people have so much hidden baggage and underlying commitments, they're prevented from addressing the real issues in your life. You ever get that feeling? You're just not given the chance to do what you should be doing. So, what do you blame it on? That's a good one to blame. It's the people and things around you. They just bring you down, right? Bring me down. You gotta move. These people I live in my neighborhood, they're just bringing me down. My job's bringing me down. School's bringing me down. Then you move, and what do you find out after you move?
The problem wasn't there.
Yeah, you brought the problem with you. It's in your mind. You ever had that feeling, Daniel? How these people are bringing the jam?
Yeah, I think I did.
Well, we should look in the mirror and ask ourselves, maybe I'm bringing myself down because I don't have any real knowledge. I'm expecting peace and contentment when I know nothing. I'm ignorant. So in this way, Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna's teachings of Bhagavad Gita will challenge you and get down underneath all your assumptions of why you're doing things. Now, many people don't want that. Many people want to live a surface life. Many people want to live a superficial life. They're threatened if you try to motivate them to think deeply. So we embarked upon this whole discussion, digging deep, digging below the surface, into hidden baggage and underlying commitments. All because Daniel started off saying, when I die. So I was struck by that. Most people would not ever say such a thing. We don't want to talk about that. One example I always give about my father, he told me, son, the whole point in life is to leave some tracks in the sand when you're gone. To do something that's notable, that's worthy of a claim. Leave some tracks in the sand when you're gone. So what do you think I asked him? He told me his son was 14, so what do you think I said?
Can you buy me a cab?
What do you think I did? I said, hey Dad, sounds great, but you leave the tracks behind, and where do you go? Son, that's not the point. You don't understand. Leave some tracks in the sand when you're gone. Okay, great. But you're gone, where do you go? He asked those kind of questions. Leave some tracks in the sand, let people think good of you. Did you ever say such a thing?
Probably not quite like that, no.
But I think it was a good question. Because of hidden baggage and underlying commitments, most people don't have the courage or the vision to really address their life, get a grip on their life. There's too many things blocking them. The days go by, the nights go by, and their life is being lived out in accordance with other people's expectations, other people's plans, other people's visions. Maybe sometimes you all have that feeling that you're being held hostage to so many other agendas. You have the social expectations, family expectations. You've got a partner, the partner has expectations. You've got to cope with all that. So how do you know what are your genuine expectations and what has been pushed upon you by social influence? So what Krishna is saying, if we go back to that 11th verse on page 87. What Krishna is saying, while speaking learned words, you're mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living or the dead. So Krishna is getting underneath all the external layers of social conditioning, family conditioning, temporary ethics and morality, and just getting to the rock bottom level. That you are spirit, soul. All these external things actually have nothing to do with you. So if you want to understand what is right, you must take your information from the Supreme Soul. Now why can't we get information about the Supreme Soul? in Bhagavad Gita, the Supreme Soul is speaking. All we have to do is listen. And if you apply what Krishna says in your life, you'll see the results. If you enter the laboratory of Bhagavad Gita, you'll see the results. No religious belief, just practical experience.
Okay, anything else?
Once you get the practical experience of Bhagavad Gita, then you can deal with this lost in the cycle of repeated birth and death. Because billions of people are lost in that cycle. Everyone's had a pinch. That's all right, you know, it's the thing to do. Whereas Bhagavad Gita is here to bring you out of a cycle of repeated birth and death. That is the actual goal in human life, how we get out of the cycle. Then where do you go? Krishna also talks about that in Bhagavad Gita, because unless you have an inspiring destination to go to, you won't take so much trouble to get there. All right. Thank you very much.
I ask a question that's
completely
away from the topic. If we believe that the soul is reincarnated into another form, how does it vary from the Buddhist belief?
Which Buddhist belief?
Who knows? Buddhism has a generalization.
Right, exactly. It's a difficult question for Buddhists because they actually don't accept that there is an eternal spiritual identity. I asked this of a Buddhist teacher in Thailand. I said that why should I become a Buddhist monk when there's no permanent identity, whether I'm a monk or a drunken taxi driver, there's no permanent identity, so why should I go through all the trouble to be a monk? He just looked at me. He didn't answer. Basically, he wanted to say that, even though there's no permanent identity for anyone, you'll have less misery in your life if you're a monk. I said, well, what does it matter? Ultimately, you know, we don't have any permanent identity. Ultimately, our individuality doesn't exist. So, it's true that for a short time that this temporary identity exists, I'll have less pain as a Buddhist monk than a drunken taxi driver. But ultimately, we're all going to cease to exist. So, why should I go through all the trouble to be a Buddhist monk?
But they don't believe in a soul, do they?
No, there's no such thing as a permanent identity.
But they still believe in reincarnation.
Something material just gathers together and
starts again. So they have this gap between where we are now and where we're going to be, and this gap to be no link.
Exactly. Nirvana, as I've explained so many times, Nirvana, Sanskrit word, Vana means forest, Nir means out of. So when you attain Nirvana, when you're out of the forest of illusion, where are you? Buddha didn't teach that. So if they're genuine Buddhists, they can only go as far as Buddha went. They didn't go beyond that point. He didn't deny there was something else. He just said, I'm not talking about it. Yeah. He said, I come to teach two things and two things only. What is dukkha? Misery. How to become free from dukkha? Misery. I'm not talking about anything else.
In the other world? He said, you came to teach two things.
What is misery? And two, how to become free from misery. But the positive thing is, he didn't say, it's like, let's say, Leon. Give this example before. Leon is banging his head against the wall day after day. Somehow I convinced Leon. stop it. Now, when he stops banging his head against the wall, certainly he's going to feel relief. But is that the end of the situation? No. What does he do with his head now that he's stopped banging it against the wall? So, Buddha's teachings enable people who follow his teachings to stop the negative, but it didn't give them any positive.
So what we're saying is you arrive at point A in birth, you end at point B in death, and between there the whole logic of life is to reduce to suffering.
Yes.
But when you get to the point B, good luck.
But at least you had less pain as a monk.
While you were here.
Yeah. Yes. I remember Srila Prabhupada, my teacher, he was talking to a Zen master in France, and so he asked, so Srila Prabhupada asked him, so what is the goal of your Zen Buddhism? And the Zen master replied just straightforwardly, our goal is to become nothing. And Srila Prabhupada said with kind of childlike curiosity, you become nothing? People are joining your movement? People are accepting this? Goal or nothing?
Another question, nothing to do with it. On Saturday night, I went to a place called Ashram Yoga, and there's two sannyasis there who were talking. And the reason I went was because they were taught that they were their guide or their spiritual master was Bhaktivedanta Swami and somebody else. Are there people who've been in Krishna? Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yes.
Are there people who've been in Krishna consciousness and decided they want to do their own thing?
Sure.
But I went along assuming that they were people from Krishna consciousness. And I have to admit, for the first hour and a half, I was lost in half asleep. and because I was talking about something that was completely beyond me. And for the final 10 minutes, I was either awake or listening, but it had some meaning.
Right.
But they were at some stage part of ISKCON.
All right, thank you very much. Dinner, Daniel?